Thank you for joining us today at Mormon Stories. A few quick reminders. If you value what we're doing here at Mormon Stories and want to keep this program alive past July 2010, please consider signing up today to become a monthly paid subscriber to Mormon Stories. All donations are tax deductible. They will go directly to the time and materials used to produce the show. And you can sign up for as little as $5 a month at mormonstories.org. Thank you for listening, and please enjoy the show.
So Damon, let's switch gears. Now that you've sort of brought us to the present, to modern Mormonism, why don't we switch back to the narrative of your life story, and let's talk about your employment at the church office building. I understand you started working there while you were finishing your PhD dissertation. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. It's a little bit ironic to be actually writing a history of a thing, and then you have to step into the history as a sort of employee of the thing that you've just been describing. When I was near the end of it, I applied for a job just almost on a whim. I never really had any notion that I'd actually get employed there. I had no experience doing what they were asking for, which was user experience research. I didn't even know what that meant.
Yeah, explain that. Explain that for our listeners. I mean, what is user experience research that you're supposed to be conducting?
Well, officially, I was supposed to be doing things like, you know, how can people click through the website to get at what they want to get at if they're searching for, you know, let's say polyandry on LDS.org. Do they, you know, how many times do they have to click the mouse to find that? You know, how long does it take them to look at the screen? To sort of find the link that they're looking for. And, you know, that's sort of the basics of, at least is what I understand about user experience research. It's a sort of web-based thing. But it turned out that that wasn't actually what they were looking for. What they were looking for is almost, you know, pretty well in line with what I had training in, which was analyzing Mormon culture and how mass media shapes Mormon culture. And so what they were looking for, apparently, was somebody who could do sort of audience research on church media. So, you know, let's say they produce a DVD that's a training video for bishops. How do people in Mexico interpret this church media? What about a church website? You know, how does it sort of translate culturally? So it was really kind of a vague job description, and I was vague enough apparently to somehow land the job.
And just you know, you're mentioning polyandry and how long it would take to find on the church website. You got me curious. So while we're sitting here, I went to LDS.org. I went into the general search screen to search all content. I typed in the word polyandry, and it tells me that your search for polyandry has returned zero results in all church content.
Yeah, it doesn't exist.
Well, this is probably a good time to segue to your book that you wrote, in which you it's, you know, basically mainly a memoir of your experience working at the church office building, and you title it The Book of Mammon, a book about the corporation that owns the Mormon Church. Why don't you tell our listeners about just picking the title, because obviously it's an interesting title. So tell the listeners, what does the title of the book tell listeners about what the book will be?
What it's about? Well, it's about a book.
Yeah.
Well, the original sort of working title was To Two Masters Bound. And, you know, I sort of got a lot of positive feedback with it, but it also seemed like maybe it was about some kind of S&M operation that was going on.
Yeah, probably not a good form of confusion for a church book.
Yeah, I mean, maybe, you know, more people would have been interested. I'm not sure. But, you know, I sort of decided to go straight with a kind of classic old school title, Book of Mammon. And in some ways, it has the potential to make it seem like I'm mocking the Book of Mormon, which is actually the exact opposite of what I'm doing with this. I try to seriously think through, if the Book of Mormon were written today, how would it be compiled? What kind of genre would it be in, for example? Would it be fiction or nonfiction? You know, and what kinds of materials would they draw from were they to write something like this? And that's not to say that I believe that the Book of Mormon is in some way sacred scripture or something like that. But nevertheless, I think the Book of Mormon provides a really important model for Mormons to try to emulate in their own writings. So the initial titles, in some ways, it's really a kind of homage to the Book of Mormon, and the kind of debts that I feel that I have to it. The subtitle kind of grew and grew and grew. Initially it was Open and Read of the Corporation That Owns the Mormons, but this was thought to be maybe confusing to people, to have an imperative sentence rather than a declarative as a subtitle. It was a little bit different than what most people expect. So the rest, to make a sort of long story short, the book is in some ways three different kinds of books all put together, just like the Book of Mormon is compiled from many different books. The storyline inside the book is that it is, in some sense, it was a found record in a database that was written by a computer, Daemon, Daemon, in some distant future where, in some ways, history and time and these kinds of things have been forgotten and are no longer understood. So it's a kind of, let's say, science fiction-y angle to try to sort of recreate the long history that the Book of Mormon enjoys, which I don't really have, me being one person who has a short lifetime. I sort of telescope everything out into the future and into the past. So, and also it was originally conceived as, in some ways, a parody of the 19th century expose. The sort of books of the Mormon Octopus, or How I Escaped from Polygamy, these kinds of books that were written and very popular in the 19th century, which nowadays, you know, it's kind of a sign of certain changes that you don't actually find a lot of these exposés being written anymore, in part because, again, the sort of controls that are put in place are great, plus what exactly are you going to expose? That Mormons have family home evening on Monday nights, you know, or that they don't drink coffee. These aren't really the sorts of things that sell a lot of books, at least as far as I understand it. So, you know, and that's in some ways another kind of commentary on the existence of things and our relationship with sort of American culture. If we're no longer sort of worthy of the expose, what role does that put us in relationship to our ancestors, you know, to the people of the 19th century?
So your reference in the title to Mammon obviously refers back to Christ's statement that you cannot serve both God and Mammon. And then the subtitle there about the corporation that owns it obviously lets the reader know that you're going to be talking about the corporate side of the church. And so let's move to that. When we're talking about the corporate structure of the church and this issue of can you serve God and Mammon, I guess kind of a theme that we'll be returning to throughout this episode is going to be one of the overarching questions is, to what extent should it be done or can it be done on earth as it is in heaven? And so your book describes the corporate structure and character of the church office building. And so this is probably a good point to trace, if you might, for us, just trace a bit of the history of the development of the church's corporate entities. So let's go back to Joseph Smith, to 1830. He organizes the church. What exactly is the nature of the earthly organization or entity that he created? I mean, did he create a corporation the way we have a corporation today?
Well, the word corporation would have been used at the time. It would have been a sort of charitable corporation or an eleemosynary corporation. And, you know, the evidence sort of suggests that he tried to conform to the legal requirements of the state of New York, which were that you had to have between 5 and 7 elders sign on if you wanted to form a sort of church corporation. So whether he really sort of went through with the legal paperwork and so on is a historical question, but it seems pretty clear that in 1830 what they're talking about is the incorporation of a church. You know, and this is something that they begin to sort of play with various models of corporate forms. Joseph Smith does, and I think part of the struggle here is to institute the Order of Enoch, or the sort of consecrated order, where a different kind of relationship to property was going to be instituted. And of course, they had a very hard time ever devising a kind of legal form here that would match what they described as going on in the Celestial Kingdom. So the, you know, Nauvoo, things are much more complicated because you have a clear overlay of the city-state of Nauvoo with the actual church itself. You know, by the time they end up in Utah, they have a trustee in trust, which eventually gets taken over by the president of the church, even though originally it was the role of the presiding bishop to be the trustee in trust. Brigham Young calls himself into the presiding bishopric, and then once the presiding bishop dies, makes himself trustee in trust. And of course, this causes all kinds of problems when Brigham Young dies in 1877. With his heirs, and he had, of course, rather numerous progeny, and all of them decided that they deserved a share of the property of Brigham Young, which was effectively the same property as what we'd call the church. So this caused all kinds of concerns with respect to how do we actually work this out so that we can have something that survives beyond the death of the president of the church or the trustee in trust. And, you know, and they had incorporated the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints in the territory under the federal law. However, this entity was disincorporated in 1890 by the United States Supreme Court. It confirmed the disincorporation that was done by some of the anti-polygamy legislation in the 1880s that we've talked about a little bit already.
So just a trace then from 1830, just a recap, from 1830 to 1890, you've got Joseph at least seeming to begin to start the process of incorporation in New York, although it's unclear whether that was accomplished. When they hit Nauvoo, though, they create a new corporation. Is that right? Under the charter that Nauvoo had?
That's right. It's a city corporation, basically.
Okay. A city corporation. But then by the time they get to Utah, we switch to the model of a trustee in trust.
And they still had the corporation of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, but it's unclear who exactly held the property, because again, these things both terminated in the same person, in Brigham Young. So when that person dies, it's not necessarily a succession crisis, but it's a crisis of who now holds the property if the trustee in trust is dead. So, you know, by 1890, they hadn't really worked these questions out, and indeed it actually got even more complicated because now there wasn't even a corporation which could hold property. So the United States government held all the property, and, for example, the temples had to be rented by the trustee in trust. And the trustee in trust actually lost his trustee, Wilford Woodruff, lost his trust, though it was eventually given back to him in 1893. Now, what happened here was sort of what you pointed out in your initial introduction about this sort of vague period of Mormon history, which is the church gets out of debt as a result of Lorenzo Snow instituting tithing. And, you know, the question, of course, is, well, why was the church in debt? And the reason why was because the government had escheated all of their property. And the second reason was because they'd gone into serious debt, something like $3 million, which would be close to probably $3 billion in today's money, to build the Salt Lake Temple. So the through the 1890s up until 1916, you only have a trustee in trust. There is, in fact, no corporation, and legally speaking, no actual church that exists. By 1916, however, Charles Nibley, who was then the presiding bishop, got the laws a little more flexible in the state of Utah and allowed them to incorporate a corporation soul.
So tell us, what is a corporation soul exactly?
A corporation soul is a what is called an individual corporation. So in sort of medieval times, there were two kinds of corporations that the Catholic Church had formed. One of them was an aggregate corporation, or corporation aggregate, which would be, for example, the Benedictine Order. It would be a separate corporation. It could have property. It would have a sort of timeless succession. It would go on forever. The other one was a corporation soul, which was designed so that the bishops could hold property in perpetuity in the office of the bishop. So when they died, it wouldn't allow the king to take all the property from the Catholic Church and claim it as his own because he refused to allow a new bishop to be ordained. And so this was a strategy by the monarchy to basically claim all the church property. The church instituted a corporation soul as a way of getting around the monarchy strategy. So it was really a kind of dead form. You don't find corporation soul throughout American history. They're very, very rare. And it was something that that Nibley apparently thought was the proper form for the presiding bishop. So he organized the corporation of the presiding bishopric as a corporation soul. And this is indeed before you actually have the corporation of the president of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, which is also a corporation soul.
And that's basically the top corporate entity today, right, is the corporation of the president.
That's right. The corporation of the president was incorporated in 1923. You can find the articles of incorporation online. They're posted as a PDF. And it's a corporation that consists of a single person who is the president of the church, and upon the death of the president of the church, it is written into the articles of incorporation that the person with seniority, that who's the president, as it were, of the quorum of the apostles, becomes the next corporation of the president of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. So the succession now is written into the laws of incorporation, and this is a rather different kind of corporation than you would have had in 1830. Whereas in 1830, when you were baptized, you would have signed on as a member of the corporation, and this gave you, you know, all the rights that would have sort of attended with that kind of corporate form that they had organized, as well as within the Articles of Incorporation.
So kind of joining this spiritual kingdom, this spiritual organization of a church, would have been reflected also on the records of the earthly organization, and not just sort of on a piece of paper, but you would actually become a member of that corporation of the church, that become a member of that legal entity. Is that right?
That's right. And this is why the principle of common consent is important. It's a legal principle as much as a spiritual principle. And as Mormons, we know that we can't really separate the spiritual from the natural world anyway.
At least that's what Brigham Young taught, right? I mean, Brigham Young taught that there is no division between spiritual and temporal, right? I mean, they're both one.
That's right. And Joseph Smith seemed to teach very much the same thing, as well as most of Mormon sort of theological writings seem to sort of build on that from the Doctrine and Covenants. So, you know, it's a question here of, you know, like you said, in what ways can we expect the earthly kingdom of God to mirror the heavenly kingdom of God? And in the early church, the idea was that they had to mirror each other perfectly. That the idea was we were going to create the heavenly kingdom here. We couldn't just sort of wait for heaven to descend upon us and teach us how to actually do things correctly. We had to actually strive for that here. And again, by the time you have this incorporation as a corporation soul, this is after a lot of the transitions that I've described in our earlier conversations that I track in the dissertation, which is really a division between spirit and flesh starts to really take hold in the theology that mirrors a division between church and state, that mirrors a division between mind and body, let's say, from a philosophical perspective. And so by the time they incorporate, the idea that we should be following the order of heaven exactly is something that a lot of folks can't really wrap their heads around, because heaven is something which is really quite abstract. by the time.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of different forms of corporation, right? I mean, so that there were available back in 1923, ostensibly, forms of corporations that could have more closely mirrored the 1830 sort of idea of having a more representative, democratic sort of corporation where the members of the church also become members of the corporation of the church. So is there did you get any clues in your research as to why Charles Nibley settled upon the corporation sole, giving sort of absolute power, as it were, to the president of the church, rather than a more sort of democratic corporation?
Well, you know, initially the power would have been all within Charles Nibley, and his record with handling finances isn't sterling. So part of it is, you know, there's always a question with somebody like Charles Nibley, not to sort of besmirch the record of, you know, of one of these church leaders who's long dead, and, you know, maybe will haunt me if I give him sort of a, you know, a bad rep here. But, you know, what you've got is really, it's a financial question, and you've got a lot of schisms going on in the church over polygamy. And I think that was the main concern, is that he was probably pretty sure that he wasn't going to become a polygamist and leave the church, so he felt pretty secure in making himself the owner of everything. And there had already been a sort of consolidation of the trusteeships. Every bishop and stake president would have been a trustee in trust over their property of their congregation. This was part of their role as a steward over the temporal side of things, where they would be handling the distribution of tithing and welfare and fast offerings.
So the idea then is, and I guess that's an important thing for you to remind us of, is that this is basically happening, this incorporation is coinciding really with another priesthood succession debate between the fundamentalists and the church leaders of the time. So I guess if you concentrate the legal ownership of the church's property in as few a hands possible, the more likely you are to ensure that that property stays within the LDS church rather than going into the what will become the FLDS church.
Yeah, and again, if you had people who were members of the corporation who were leaving, if you had a bishop, for example, who was the trustee in trust over his congregation, he could leave and he would take the property. You could have no claim over him. So early in the 1900s, you know, they had already sort of consolidated this, and Lorenzo Snow had basically made himself the kind of super trustee in trust of all the other trustees. And I think by the time Nibley does this in 1916, the concern is that Joseph F. Smith, who's the trustee in trust, isn't going to be here much longer. And when he dies, are you going to have local congregations basically breaking off and claiming property? You know, this is going to be a protracted legal problem for the church. So by forming a corporation sole, it makes it so that even if Charles Nibley dies, that the next guy in line is going to immediately become the new corporation. And so you really do sort of cut out the feet from any kind of legal challenge that fundamentalists might put forward.
And so I guess once again, this is an example of how, you know, you can certainly understand the motives or the good intentions behind choosing a corporation sole to sort of be able to weather the storm in case of any sort of fracture within the church with fundamentalists or anyone else. But is there anything to be worried about in this legal form of the corporation sole? I mean, what is the worst case scenario that the president of the church, as the president of the corporation, could do? I mean, could he go so far as to turn all the meeting houses into bowling alleys if he wanted?
Yeah, this was a comment that that came up on the post by Common Consent, where one of these corporation lawyers, who obviously understands the law much better than I do, was certain that the church couldn't possibly be a corporation sole, because that would mean that they could turn everything into a bowling alley, you know, all the chapels into bowling alleys, you know, and they could, actually. The president of the church could do whatever he wants with the property. There are, as far as I understand, no real legal constraints on what he does with it. You know, it's supposed to be put towards religious uses or charitable uses, but, you know, those are fairly vague categories. So it's even more than, you know, let's say we don't have to worry about President Monson suddenly becoming a bullying fanatic, but that he obviously doesn't sign off on everything. They have technology that mimics his signature, and so you could actually have literally machines running this corporation without any kind of actual physical person who is incorporated. They could literally have a machine sign off as the new president of the church. And it's a kind of absurd scenario. But nonetheless, it actually could happen.
Yeah, I mean, near the beginning of your book, when you sort of set up this discussion of the existence of the church as a corporation and its corporate entities, you challenge readers with an assertion that you may or may not have intended to be taken seriously, and that's what I ask you about. And that assertion is, you say, quote, there's no such thing as the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. It is a trademark. And I imagine that there may be some listeners whose ears are burning right now upon hearing the assertion that there's no such thing as the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, that it's a trademark. So can you explain what you meant by that?
Yeah, I mean, this is me sort of being a letter of the law. And according to the letter of the law, there really isn't a church. It hasn't existed since 1890. And that phrase actually is just a trademark that is owned by the corporation Soul. Am I trying to sort of take away people's experience as members of what they would call the church? Of course not. But what I'm trying to do is, in some ways, yeah, of course, be provocative, but also to begin to ask the reader to really think through what makes them a Mormon. Is it the fact that they show up to a certain property on a certain day of the week? Does that make you a member of the church? Because legally speaking, you don't really have much more of a role than that. You might donate some of your money to this corporation. You might show up. You might give them your time. But is that really what makes you a Mormon? Or is being a Mormon now a sort of cultural phenomenon? And if that's the case, then where exactly does this thing called the church exist? So it's a way of kind of asking the reader to do something that anthropologists do as a result of a great deal of training, which is put themselves outside the culture and then try to see it from the inside. And I'm trying to force the reader into this sort of culture shock by, in some ways, taking them out of the thing that they believe that they're a member of, and then asking them to really prove to themselves or to somebody else, or, you know, I guess they could disregard it, of course, but what really makes you a member of the church, or what really makes you a Mormon? Are these things, do they coincide perfectly, or is there really a distinction between them?
So I imagine some listeners are basically might be saying in their head something like, well, so what if the church exists as a corporation Soul, and that maybe technically there's no such legal entity called the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, that the legal entity is the corporation of the president of the church and the corporation of the presiding bishop and whatnot. I mean, I imagine you might have people respond by saying, hey, you know, Jesus said, my kingdom is not of this world. So can't a church or a spiritual kingdom exist kind of independent or regardless of whether or how it's recognized by the laws of man?
It's a good question, and it's one of those things that I honestly haven't resolved, but I really do want the reader to begin to ask that kind of question. And it really is, I think, a very serious thing that we all ought to be thinking about. Yeah, of course, the kingdom of heaven doesn't need to be incorporated here by the laws of the state of Utah, but as Mormons, we also understand that we can't have complete disregard for the laws that operate in the world in which we inhabit as mortal beings. So, you know, again, it's this relationship between the spirit of the law and the letter of the law, or between the spirit and the flesh, that really kind of gets at the heart of it. So You know, from my angle as an anthropologist, I mean, I can't really answer these sorts of metaphysical questions. I can pose them, but I can't really provide any solutions. But, you know, as an anthropologist, I can say that as a result of organizing as a corporation soul, rather than as a standard nonprofit corporation, which most churches are, except maybe the Catholic Church, you know, if you were to go to a Methodist church, you would be a part of that corporation. You'd have the same rights as you'd have if you were a shareholder or an employee of IBM.
Mm-hmm. So you've explained the first part of your assertion, which was the assertion that there's no such thing as the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Could you explain for us the second part of your assertion that the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is a trademark? It is, as it were, a corporate DBA, sort of a name, a brand name under which a corporation does business.
Yeah, I mean, I don't really know sort of what else to go into besides that the church doesn't exist except as a kind of social fiction, which is legally managed as a trademark. So other churches or other corporations, of course, couldn't brand their building with that trademark, though if you remove the hyphen, you can. Or if you change a capitalization here and there, you can actually trademark a very similar name. You know, and sort of the implication of this, of course, is that if there isn't a Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, it's just a trademark. You can't really be a member of a trademark. You can own a trademark, but you can't really be a member of it. So, you know, this is part of the other assertion that there aren't really any members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints because the thing just, honestly, it doesn't exist legally. So, you know,
let's talk about that. I mean, because you know, you and I and, you know, everyone else who's a member of the church, we probably have this thing called a baptismal certificate. And I think most of us sort of regard that as sort of a kind of hard copy acknowledgement of the fact that we are members of this thing that we call the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. On church records itself, how is our membership acknowledged, and you know, who owns those records, and in what format are they kept?
Well, this would be regarded as the intellectual property of IRI, or Intellectual Reserve, which is of course just a subsidiary corporation.
There's a subsidiary called Intellectual Reserve Inc. That's a subsidiary of the Corporation of the Presiding Bishop, right?
Right.
Which is a subsidiary of the Corporation of the President of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. So IRA has some database of records. Is that what you're saying?
That's right. And so you actually would be entered in as, you know, by your member number into a database. And, you know, sort of what the information that they would regard as relevant would also be entered in, your age, you know, your status with respect to temple ordinances, you know, whether you're dead, and also, you know, how much you've donated. And also, as I talk about in the book, whether you've had any serious transgressions that would need an asterisk next to your membership number.
Is that, when you say that, is that, are you saying asterisk literally or figuratively?
Literally. There would be some kind of a marker on your membership number, which would notify if you were to move, let's say, and your records were to be moved to another congregation, the bishop would be required to call the database administrators and get the information that was put on your membership file. So this would, of course, be if you had confessed of something, or if your bishop knew of something, and even if you hadn't been to church in 20 years, and even if you had been excommunicated, and had been sort of brought back into the fold, all this stuff would stay with your membership record. So, again, it's a question of how does the membership record mirror, say, our spiritual relationship to heaven? And in some ways, there's not a perfect fit because the database doesn't forgive sins quite as easily, apparently, as Jesus might. It's like in O Brother, Where Art Thou, where the you might be sort of forgiven of your sins in the eyes of heaven, but the state of Mississippi is a little more hard-nosed. The database is a little more hard-nosed in its forgiveness.
Because the asterisk never comes off?
You have to get permission from the First Presidency to get that removed.
Your book provides several examples where you saw a clash between the interests of the church and the interests of the corporate entities. And I'd like to talk about the example of the clash between the nonprofit distribution department, you know, the department that distributes scriptures and whatnot, with the clash between that nonprofit department and the for-profit Deseret Book department. When and the example you use is when the new quad came out several years back, there became this clash between distribution and Deseret Book. And can you walk us through that just to kind of illustrate what you're talking about here?
Right. So you've got Church Distribution, which is a division of Materials Management, which is a department that manages all the material aspects of the church. And then you've got a separate corporation, of course, Deseret Book. And of course, they're both owned by the presiding bishop. But what you had here in 1979, you had a new version of the LDS Bible that was done. And prior to 1979, you could take any Bible you wanted to Sunday school, and hardly anybody was using the same kind of Bible, though probably most of them used the King James. And the LDS version of the Bible is based on the King James, but it's got a lot of footnotes and other chapter headings, things like that, which allowed them to then copyright it as an LDS King James. So with the quad, where they stitched together the King James LDS version of the Bible, the Book of Mormon, the Pearl of Great Price, and then the Doctrine and Covenants, you also had inserted into that a fifth book of Scripture, which is the Bible Dictionary, which is in some ways treated as a work of Scripture by some Latter-day Saints. And the problem here was in the early 80s that after they had sort of the publication announcement and a lot of fanfare, that nobody was buying the quad. And so people went around and tried to figure out what exactly the problem was, despite all the sort of admonitions to buy this new quad. This is really sort of key to your development spiritually. And the sort of decision was that it was because Deseret Book was advertising only the $100 version of the quad. So the complication here was that Deseret Book, of course, as a for-profit, though it is owned by the corporation Soul, its management and its employees had an interest in showing that they were making money. Whereas Church Distribution, which was going to be distributing the quad as well, doesn't really have an interest in making money. It has an interest in getting the scriptures out to people for as minimal a cost as possible. So what you had here was the idea is that people weren't buying from Church Distribution, and these are sort of back and forth letters between managers of Deseret Book and managers of Church Distribution, is that it was Deseret Book's fault that they were advertising these books.
Only the expensive version.
That's right, and they had an interest in not talking about the cheaper version, which they were in some ways bound to sell at a certain price, which was basically at a loss from their perspective.
So basically, you could get the $100 version, or you could get the sort of much less expensive. You could get the $100 version of Deseret Book, or you could get a much less expensive version at distribution. But basically, the whole marketing campaign for the quad was run by Deseret Book, and they were just advertising the most expensive version. Is that it?
That's right. Church Distribution had no marketing campaign. Now, Deseret Book came back, and they said, well, the problem is not the $100 quads that we're selling. It's that we can't sell quads in pink, in green, and white, which are the colors that we believe the consumer wants. And so they sat down, and they really had negotiations between apostles about what kind of colors are they going to allow Deseret Book to sell the quad in? And of course, nowadays you can get it in many different colors. So you can see the Deseret Book clearly carried the day in their argument that if we have the quad in light pink or fuchsia, that people are more apt to own them and to buy them. And the distribution center was pleased with this, so long as Deseret Book was clear that they would also not hide what they called the Style C, which was the sort of cheapo version, which Deseret Book was accused of basically putting into the ghetto of the store so that no one would buy it. They literally didn't want people to buy the Style C because it was carried at a loss on their balance sheets. So here you've got a kind of complicated relationship, which is, of course, their interest, both sides, is to get the new scriptures out to the Mormons. But from Desert Book's side, it's, well, we can get the scriptures out, but we ought to get it out at a profit because, as employees, that's our job. And, of course, they marketed, whereas distribution didn't market. And so what you begin to see here is that the sort of resolution of this problem made its way all the way into General Conference, and a special satellite broadcast that preceded General Conference, where one of the heads of church printing wrote a talk for a church, for a leading church figure, just basically provide an advertisement for the new quad, so that people would then have information about where they could buy the quad at church distribution, as well as a Deseret Book. So you have here the literal movement into the spheres of kind of sacred religious sermons, as a way of resolving what amounted to a kind of internecine warfare between the nonprofit church distribution and the for-profit Deseret Book.
And so I guess this is a good point to ask. I mean, why is there such a thing as a for-profit department of the corporation of Deseret Book? I mean, if we're a church, we want the scriptures to go out, we have a distribution center. Why do we need this additional for-profit Deseret Book entity that, as we've seen in this example, sometimes gets in the way of the distribution center's mission of putting as many scriptures in as many hands possible at the lowest price?
You know, the answer to that, you'd have to ask various people who are probably long dead. My sense is that they acquired Deseret Book, which was a kind of independent bookseller, and rather than sort of convert it into another distribution outlet, they decided to keep it as a for-profit, again, in the mirror of what GM was having a great deal of success throughout the early and most of the 20th century, which was if you can have the principles of capitalism regulating your production of these things, that creates a kind of feedback among the membership. And so you can have a better gauge of what the members want and control for waste this way. The problem, of course, is that we aren't, and the corporation isn't, a for-profit corporation that is selling commodities to a market. And so the model here of a marketplace doesn't make sense from a business perspective. Because, of course, we're not a business and this isn't a market. So you have a very kind of schizophrenic model here where your revenue stream isn't really very connected to your product line.
Well, what do you mean? Explain that a little bit, how your revenue stream isn't connected to your product line.
Well, let's say you want to start a company where you're going to make shoes. Your gauge as to whether you're reaching the market is, of course, how many pairs of shoes you actually sell. And of course, the price point and all these different matters play a role with respect to sort of understanding. It provides a representation of your ability to understand the market. However, if you are printing millions of dollars worth of manuals every year, and you're providing them seemingly at no cost to millions of people, and then these millions of people are also donating and funding and subsidizing the arm of your company, you can imagine if you were to sell your shoes on this basis, that your shoes might begin to reflect the interests of the people who are making the shoes rather than the interests of the people who are buying the shoes. So think of it this way. Let's say you could make any kind of car you want. The Simpsons has a great episode of this where Homer designs the car that he wants. And it's a monstrosity. And they try to sell the car. I believe Homer's brother is the owner of the car company. And of course, nobody buys the car. Now, what we have set up in the church is in some ways a functioning system where the Homer Simpsons of the world, not to be rude, but, you know, it's a metaphor, the Homer Simpsons of the world can design any kind of monstrosity of a car and send it out at no cost, seemingly, and that the revenue stream that they're using to build these cars is independent from the actual act of buying the car.
And regardless of whether people want the car or like the car,
it's free, right? So why not just take it home and put it on your shelf or park it in your driveway? And of course, the revenue stream is going to not necessarily depend upon whether you like the latest, you know, automobile that they're putting out.
So it sounds like. Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that you know, I imagine few people change their the amount that they tithe as a result of whether they really like the lesson that week.
Mm-hmm. So you provide another example, kind of sticking with scriptures and scripture distribution. You spend some time discussing the history of what they called the missionary edition of the Book of Mormon, and you explained how that became tied eventually to the family-to-family campaign, as well as the broader message of flooding the earth with the Book of Mormon. So maybe could you kind of summarize that or briefly recount that story for us?
Yeah, well, one of the problems with the Quad is that you had this massive volume, which wasn't really in the interest of missionaries to cart around on their backpacks. And so they created the Missionary Edition. It was kind of a trimmed-down version of the Book of Mormon. It had fewer footnotes. And, of course, it didn't have the Bible and the other books. And it was viewed as sort of a kind of key to the conversion process, and they had some research that showed that the Book of Mormon was indeed important in the conversion process. So in the mid-1980s, they produced millions of these in church distribution, because that's your job as in church printing, is to print books. And so you have this new order of, we need these books, and so they printed millions of these books. The problem, however, was that the storehouses and the inventory houses that would be distributing these books to the mission presidents were still full of the old versions of the Book of Mormon. So that doesn't seem like much of a problem, right? I mean, why not just give them all the Book of Mormon? Well, it's a problem for the directors of temporal affairs, who are then sort of over the warehouses where these Book of Mormons would be housed.
Because how do you give them away, right? I mean, they operate the warehouses that store them, but how do they get rid of them?
It would show a loss on their on their account books, and that wouldn't please their management. And so they were in direct, the directors of temporal affairs were in direct conflict with the mission presidents. The mission president said, well, we've been told we need these new missionary editions, and yet they couldn't get them because the directors of temporal affairs were saying, well, we need to move the old inventory first. So this came to a kind of resolution through a number of different outlets. One of them was getting President Benson to announce that our initiative as Mormons is to flood the earth with the Book of Mormon. Now, this didn't resolve the sort of problem between the mission presidents and the directors of temporal affairs, but what it did is it created a new market of consumers for the Book of Mormon among the viewers of the General Conference. And of course, how many Book of Mormons do you really need to carry around at your house? Well, the idea was that if you buy one for you and maybe a couple for your neighbors, you could then pass these books on to your neighbors. So what you had here was a marketing plan, which was called the family-to-family program, where you would put your picture in the cover and write your testimony, and then you'd mail it out. And every General Conference, the Church News would run stories of people who bought cases of the Book of Mormon, of copies of the Book of Mormon, and then would send them out to missionaries. So you had here a sort of ingenious way of getting Book of Mormons into the hands of missionaries, which satisfied, of course, spiritual impulses among the membership to do good works and to get those books out there so that people could convert and enjoy the gospel. But you also had a nice way of resolving an inventory backlog. And the sort of the way that this was resolved was, again, the admonition to flood the earth and to do it through this family-to-family program.
So it's interesting, you know, kind of going back to what we were just talking about taking the sort of American corporate model and trying to apply that to the church and its operations. I mean, what we're kind of talking about is a corporation where the consumers have an unusual level of devotion and loyalty to the CEO of the corporation, such that when the CEO tells them that they need a new product, the consumers then go out and purchase the new product. I mean, you don't really have that paralleled anywhere in the marketplace.
Well, and not just for themselves, but they'll purchase it for other people because they really believe it. So, you know, this would be like if you have a friend who's really into Apple, buying a bunch of iPads and then passing them out to his friends as a result of sort of a new kind of program.
I mean, because the CEO tells you that you need to do that.
Yeah. It maybe appears as a crass way of talking about it, but when you read the meeting minutes from the materials management department, this is in some ways how they talk about it, that they couldn't have sold nearly as many Book of Mormons without the help of President Benson.
And yet you mentioned in your book that the sort of net impact of this is that sales triple.
That's right. They go up until you have like 6 million being printed and quote-unquote sold in 1990, which was approximately the same number of people who are on record as being Mormons or, you know, Latter-day Saints that same year. So you had really one book being printed and sold for every member of the church. After they dismantle the family-to-family program, because they institute a new way of donating to the Book of Mormon fund on the tithing slip as a result of sort of getting around certain tax concerns. You could donate in liquid capital to this fund, and then church distribution would just pass them out to the missionaries through that channel. So they sort of resolved it, the sort of tax question resolved it. But yeah, again, the fact that they were printing so many more Book of Mormons was, you know, on graphs, and it was presented to general authorities, and it was presented to the Quorum of the Twelve that we are indeed meeting the instructions of our prophet. But we were also, you know, this looks good for the guys who are in church printing and in church distribution. It's good for their careers.
Mm-hmm. You know, you also raise another example of garment production in South America and that how that ended up creating a glut of unused inventory of temple clothing, and you describe the way that problem was dealt with. Can you briefly summarize that episode for our listeners?
Yeah, I'll try to be brief with it. it's really very complicated. What you have is the Beehive Clothing, which manufactures the garments and sort of became the de facto maker of these of the sort of quote unquote Mormon underwear. They had a hard time keeping employees on because they were paying, as they said in materials management, a below poverty wage, and this is in the 1980s. So they weren't paying their employees enough to really live on.
This is in the United States?
That's right. This is in Salt Lake City. And so what you have here is, well, we've got to keep the cost down because, as I said, they have a price-conscious consumer here that they need to sell these goods to, meaning Mormons are cheap, apparently. Nice way of saying it. They want their underwear cheap.
We're frugal, right?
That's right. And who doesn't? And of course, it's a required purchase, so it ought to be as cheap as possible, I suppose.
Sure.
And of course, you could just make your own. But nevertheless, they also had a problem of getting garments into certain Latin American countries like Venezuela, where there was a really steep import tax on these when you'd bring in these kinds of garments, not just religious garments, but garments in general. And so they got permission from the higher ups. Beehive Clothing got permission to contract with factories in Venezuela, so then they could produce these garments locally and get them to the members at a cheap price, and thereby allow the members to sort of keep their covenants as they've made them. Now, this is a great plan, and it seems to be working pretty well. But then, sort of the mammon side of things steps in and says, "Well, now that we have permission to go international in terms of the production of garments, it makes a little more sense financially to go to places where there is an established garment production factory." So they began to look at moving the production of garments into Mexico and into Uruguay, where, of course, they have a kind of established tradition. We have words for what these kinds of factories are. But it made sense financially to do this. And the church accountants had said, "Well, you can't get your garments into Venezuela the way you've been getting them in," which was, apparently, stashing suitcases full of these things and paying a guy to then bribe the customs agent, a sort of local guy who was chummy with the customs agents, would smuggle garments in and would bribe the customs officials to get them through customs. And the auditing department said no more of this. So you had here a real legal conundrum and a religious problem as well, which was solved really by way of just looking at the raw numbers, that you could then import stuff from Mexico and make it so cheap that the imports didn't really drive the prices up that high. And of course, what happened here was that the guys in Beehive Clothing have an interest in producing as many pairs of garments as they can.
For as cheaply as possible.
That's right, because this is, you know, a way of sort of serving God. And you had then, however, a kind of glut of temple clothing. This glut of temple clothing was solved eventually by an announcement that was read in congregations that every member ought to have their own set of temple clothing. Now, whether, of course, this was driven by the inventory backlog is a different matter. But nevertheless, with the growth of the temples in the 1990s, as part of President Hinckley's sort of temple building plan, you had a real uptick in the number of garments and temple clothing that were being produced. Until by the late 1990s, you actually have, they're actually not able to keep up with demand as a result of this admonition that Mormons ought to own their own pair of temple clothes rather than rent them from the temple.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Stories. To comment on this episode or to provide feedback, please check us out at mormonstories.org. If you want to help keep Mormon Stories alive, please consider either making a financial contribution or spreading the word about this episode through your blog, Twitter account, Facebook page, family newsletter, or through your ward bulletin and ward newsletter. Just kidding about those last two. Music on this episode was provided by Clayton and Sky Pixton. Check them out at claytonpixton.com or skypixton.com. That's Sky with an E, S-K-Y-E, pixton.com. Thank you.
Nearer, my God, to thee, nearer.